Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Descrizione del Sacro Monte della Vernia is a rare and unusual illustrated volume about the Franciscan sanctuary of La Verna, depicting the monastery and dramatic rocky terrain where Francis of Assisi, 1181-1182 to 1226, received the stigmata nearly 400 years earlier. Jacopo Ligozzi, 1547 to 1627, a celebrated draftsman and then head of the Academy of Drawing in Florence, created 22 preparatory drawings in 1608 that were subsequently etched or engraved into full-page plates for the volume. It is the centerpiece of the exhibition Heavenly Earth, Images of St. Francis at La Verna, on view at the National Gallery of Art through July 8, 2018. In this lecture, held on June 24, 2018, Ginger Hammer expands on the art historical context of traditional representations of St. Francis at La Verna and the innovations in Franciscan subject matter characteristic of the Counter-Reformation.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Ginger Hammer. I'm an assistant curator here in Old Master Prints and Drawings at the National Gallery. And this afternoon, I'll be speaking about a rare and unusual illustrated volume, two copies of which are featured in the exhibition Heavenly Earth, Images of St. Francis at La Verna. Published in 1612, the volume depicts the Franciscan sanctuary and rugged natural wonders of La Verna, an area of wilderness in the Cosentino, east of Florence and north of Arezzo. You can kind of see the area up here. La Verna features a solitary peak known as Monte Penna and is covered with a forest of beech and fir trees. According to early accounts, in September 1224, Francis of Assisi withdrew to this mountain with three companions to spend the Lent of St. Michael in fasting and contemplation of Christ's passion. During this retreat, Francis prayed fervently to share in Christ's suffering. He separated himself from his companions, allowing only his devoted brother Leo to visit him once a day with a little bread and water. The answer to Francis's spiritual longing came in a vision of a fiery six-winged angel, or seraph, bearing the image of Christ crucified. As the seraph departed, the wounds of Christ's crucifixion, called the stigmata, appeared on Francis's own body. He bore those wounds for the remaining 2 years of his life. Today, the sanctuary of La Verna remains an active monastery, a place of pilgrimage, and is preserved as a sacred site by the Franciscan order. Roughly 400 years after Francis stayed there, in 1607 or 1608, the Franciscan brother Lino Moroni invited the artist Jacopo Ligozzi, a celebrated draftsman and then head of the Academy of Drawing in Florence, to accompany him to La Verna to illustrate the place associated with St. Francis and his early companions. Ligozzi's 22 preparatory drawings were subsequently etched or engraved into full-page plates for our volume titled Descrizione del Sacro Monte della Vernia, which translates as the description of the Holy Mountain or Sacred Mountain of La Verna. Hereafter, I'll refer to it simply as the volume or our volume or the Descrizione because that title is really a mouthful. Each plate includes a lettered key so readers can learn about the topographical features or particular stories associated with the illustration. Several images additionally boast a cleverly designed overslip or flap, which when lifted, reveal another view or detail of La Verna. Sort of hard to see in the photo. We have them partially lifted in the exhibition so that you can see at an angle what they look like when they're open or closed. As an assistant curator, one of my responsibilities is to catalog newly acquired rare books for our art collection. We acquired the Descrizione in 2013, and as I started to delve into it, I discovered how unusual it is, and I began thinking about building a small focus show around the volume, which ultimately resulted in the exhibition now on view. The Dumbarton Oaks Museum in Georgetown also owns a copy, which I studied for comparison. And as luck would have it, the rare book collection within our own library also recently acquired a copy, which allowed us to simultaneously exhibit two different openings within the book. an unusual occurrence and the benefit of owning multiple copies. You might think that these are mass-produced. They're not. There are only about 11 known copies in public collections. To begin to understand this volume, I found it necessary to explore several broad-ranging topics, and those I will quickly review with you now. Each topic represents an extensive field of research in its own right, but I hope with this overview to offer you a framework to understand what might otherwise strike you as a relatively unremarkable guidebook to a little-known holy site, except for Franciscans and devout Catholics. So in the next hour, I will briefly review the selection criteria I used for the exhibition, a brief history of European printmaking and the creation of flap books, some biographical background for Francis of Assisi, basic iconography in Franciscan images, and the impact of the Protestant Reformation and the so-called Counter-Reformation on images of St. Francis. I'll also review a little bit about Jacopo Legozzi, the featured artist. And finally, I'll give you a virtual tour of La Verna using Legozzi's celebrated volume as our guide. Here we go. Also, just so you know, almost everything I'm showing today is part of the National Gallery's collection, so I left the credit lines off, except if the work comes from another collection. Because our volume falls within the period of the Counter-Reformation, we decided to situate it within a selection of objects dating from the 15th through the 18th centuries. Those centuries saw rapid developments in printmaking, both technically and artistically, and the subsequent widespread distribution of printed material often was for religious purposes. Because few people were literate at this time, illustrations played a significant role in printmaking. St. Francis of Assisi was, and still is, a beloved and revered figure. He died in 1226 and was canonized only 2 years later. In the decades that followed his death, fresco cycles and paintings of Francis were commissioned in abundance. In 1999, the scholar William Cook published his noteworthy attempt to document all early extant images of St. Francis up until circa 1320. His research led him to describe the amount of art dedicated to Francis in the century after his death as the Francis phenomenon. In his words, quote, "There are slightly more than 200 early images of Francis whose locations are currently known. If Edward Garrison is right that the survival rate of 13th century paintings is only about 1%, we face the staggering notion that there may have been as many as 20,000 images of Francis created in Italy in less than a century." And this was before works on paper were circulated. When I did an initial collection search for the name St. Francis, I found 66 works of art in our collection with that name, 27 of which are in the exhibition. What surprised me is that we had several 20th century portraits of Francis as well, such as this marvelous woodcut by M.C. Escher, surrounded by birds. Francis's loving relationship with animals, especially birds, is a topic that endears him to people today, and I dare say has made him an ever-popular subject for garden statues. But those who knew him revered him as a great spiritual master, one who embraced all of humanity, regardless of their religion or their station in life. A quick Google search taught me that Francis is now the patron saint of animals, birds, merchants, ecologists and environmentalists, families, lace makers, needleworkers, welfare societies, peace, tapestry workers, zoos, and even stowaways. He is also the patron saint of numerous cities around the world. His legacy is so far-reaching that in 1981, even Marvel Comics illustrated his life in a comic book titled Francis, Brother of the Universe. And of course, in 2013, Cardinal Bergoglio chose to honor St. Francis by taking his name. I found all of this information fun and informative, but ultimately, I had to scale down the exhibition to a relevant number of works, which would be appropriate to accompany our volume. So now, some background. To appreciate the technical and artistic qualities in the descrizione, it's helpful to have some background about the history of European printmaking. And for the time frame we're discussing, the primary print techniques being used were either relief or intaglio prints. In general, fine art prints all have two things in common. They must be designed in reverse so that when they are printed onto a sheet of paper, the result will look how the artist intended rather than a mirror image of what they want. And two, most printmaking techniques yield multiple images, each of which is considered an original print. We refer to these originals as impressions. Printing in relief means that the artist is carving around the design, leaving the design in the surface, on the surface, to be inked with a roller and then printed. I think you can get a good sense of that here, carving away this backward N, put your paper on, you peel it off, and you get your N. You cannot achieve different shades or tone with a relief print. You either get ink or no ink, usually black or the white of the paper. Woodcuts in Western art evolved out of a tradition of textile printing. And although paper was known in Spain as far back as the 11th century, it was not produced in large quantities in Europe until the 14th century, allowing woodcut printing to flourish in the two centuries after that. Early woodcuts were often of religious figures and were sold to pilgrims visiting holy places. Some were displayed for religious feast days, some were placed within strong boxes for protecting one's valuables when traveling. This particular work on the screen is a rare impression of a late 15th century Italian woodcut depicting St. Francis receiving the stigmata. Early woodcut designs like this were simple and stylized. They often featured wide, bold lines with few curved lines, as these were easier to carve around without the wood chipping away and ruining your design. When you see bits of the design missing ink, it means the wood block became chipped and was printed without being repaired. And you can see that in this, in the border, there's some pieces missing, as well as his hair and in his cordelier down here. Although prints like this were mass-produced, they were considered ephemera, like modern handbills, and were generally not preserved. Therefore, very few exist today. For example, there are only two known impressions of this particular work in the world. Because artists could not achieve tone in relief prints, we see hand-colored woodcuts virtually as soon as woodcuts were created. You can recognize early hand coloring because the color didn't always stay within the lines. This object, called a block book, is an important example of early religious book manufacturing and is hand colored. Block books are short books of up to 50 leaves, printed in the second half of the 15th century, from blocks carved to include both text and illustrations. The content was nearly always religious and was aimed at a popular audience. Although Gutenberg had invented movable type by this time, block books were still printed in the 1460s or later and seemed to have functioned as a cheap alternative to the typeset book, which was still very expensive at this stage. This particular block book is extremely rare. It's called a Biblia Pauperum, or Pauper's Bible. It was created in the tradition of picture Bibles. It pairs scenes from the life of Christ with Old Testament prefigurations. A Biblia Pauperum was generally utilized by a clergy as a teaching aid for those who could not read, which included most of the population. The tradition of prefiguring Old Testament figures with events with the New Testament was revived and altered in Franciscan iconography, where scenes from the life of Christ were depicted as prefiguring events in Francis's life. We'll circle back to this topic in a bit. In roughly 40 years, we see a tremendous leap forward in the sophistication of woodcuts, both technically and stylistically. In this stunning woodcut carved by Niccolò Bodrini after design by Titian, we see increasingly refined graphic patterns never before achieved in woodcut. Titian is revered as a Venetian painter, but he designed fewer than 20 woodcuts, yet his designs, his woodcut designs, influenced the development of graphic work throughout Italy and beyond. I'll speak more about the subject of this remarkable print a bit later. For now, I just wanted to demonstrate how far relief printing came in a few short decades. Engraving emerged in the late 15th century, and by 1600 had virtually replaced woodcut as the preeminent technique for illustrations. Unlike relief prints, when you which you carve around your design. With engraving, you are incising your design into a metal plate, rubbing the ink into those lines, wiping the excess ink off the surface, and then pulling the design out of the plate using dampened paper run through a press. Metal plates wouldn't chip like wood, therefore far more quality impressions could be made before your image would degrade. That's the reason that money is still printed from engraved plates today. Like woodcut, you still can't create tone. You either have black ink or no ink. But because you can incise lines much closer together than you can cut around them in wood, your eyes are fooled into believing that you are seeing tone. I'll show you a 16th century engraving and then a 17th century engraving to demonstrate how quickly we see artistic refinements in the technique. Here's an engraving of St. Francis by Annibale Carracci. The Carracci family of artists were known for preferring a naturalism of expression over the prevailing mannerist artificiality, which was popular at the time. Annibale used the burin to coarsely incise into the plate. The burin is the tool that I showed a moment ago. With that, he emphasized the rugged aspects of nature, as well as Francis's own disregard for the comfort and appearance of his body. This rough gouging of the burin is especially evident in Francis' fingers, which hold steadfastly to the crucifix. You can see that here. And he's really just digging into the plate in a lot of areas. His amazing toes. This style of engraving contrasts greatly with the refined technique we find a century later in work by the French artist Claude Melon. Melon was known for an idiosyncratic engraving style in which he preferred parallel lines to crosshatch lines, which he simply cut deeper and wider to hold more ink, giving you the appearance of shadow. And I think you can get a sense of that here. These are all just parallel lines. There's a few cross the other way, but in general, this is his style. And it's fairly unique. Etchings developed shortly after engravings and were often used in combination with engraving, which is the case in our volume. With etching, you first coat the plate with an acid-resist ground. Then you can draw or scratch through that ground using an etching needle to reveal the copper beneath. Then you dip your plate into an acid bath. The acid eats away wherever the copper is revealed, and it does the incising for you. So you don't have to dig into it with a burin like you do with engraving. This development freed artists to draw with ease onto the plate. During the 16th and 17th centuries, we see all of these print techniques in use, sometimes to illustrate books and sometimes to reproduce paintings, such as this example by Peter Klaus Sudmann after a painting by Bassano. We call these reproductive prints. Recent scholarship has given us greater understanding of the history of flap books. Books with movable parts date back as far as the 13th century and were most often used for mathematical and astronomical calculations. For example, a rotating disk attached to a page beneath with a thread might compute the phases of the moon, that sort of thing. The popularity of moving parts gained strength in the 16th century with the invention of flap anatomy books, where one layer of anatomy could be lifted to reveal another beneath. Our volume, published in 1612, falls right in with this tradition of flat books, only it is cleverly applied to a landscape rather than for scientific use. Modern pop-up books come from this tradition. Francis of Assisi was known for embracing the divine qualities of the physical world as evidence of God's design. One of his most famous writings, The Canticle of the Sun, or Praise of the Creatures, is a song written in the Umbrian dialect of Italian rather than in ecclesiastical Latin, which made it widely accessible. The song praises God for the gifts of the sun, wind, fire, and so forth, all of which are tenderly referred to as brothers or sisters. These simple yet powerful expressions of divine love, combined with Francis's strict adherence to a life of poverty and humility, helped drive his popularity among the laity. And I'm going to borrow from the Marvel illustrators for his biography because they did a great job. In his youth in Assisi, Francis was known for drinking and reveling. His mother was French, and his father, Pietro Bernardone, was a successful cloth merchant. Francis was a rebellious teenager. He was known for his charm and his vanity, a confirmed sinner. He left school at age 14, and he honed his skills instead in archery and horsemanship, and began daydreaming of becoming a knight, the medieval version of an action hero. He got his wish. In 1202, war broke out between Assisi and neighboring Perugia, and Francis eagerly joined the cavalry. This experience would alter the course of his life. The soldiers from Assisi came under heavy attack, many took flight, many were immediately put to death. With no combat experience and wearing expensive new armor, Francis was captured and considered worthy of ransom, so he was spared. Francis was imprisoned in an underground cell in miserable conditions and spent nearly a year there awaiting ransom from his father. He reportedly became very ill and began to have spiritual visions. In 1203, he was released and returned to Assisi, a very different man. He fell ill again for an extended period. He had several spiritual visions at this time, which guided him to begin rebuilding the neglected churches around Assisi, stone by stone. He gave up the wealthy trappings of the life he had known, and he began caring for lepers and the poor, and even animals and birds. He soon gathered a circle of 12 companions who were likewise willing to give up all wealth and comfort in order to follow his joyful example and strict adherence to the gospel. I won't go into extensive stories related to Francis today, but I will mention a couple of signal experiences. At dawn on April 16th, 1208, Francis went to the church of San Niccolo in the square, the central square in Assisi. He took two companions with him, and his goal was to consult the gospel texts for spiritual direction for himself and his brothers. There is evidence to suggest that Francis may have consulted this very missal, known as Codex W75, which is now in the collection of the Walters Art Museum in nearby Baltimore. The three entered the church and prayed that the Lord would show them his will. Francis opened the book three times because he wanted the divine message he was seeking to be confirmed by a threefold affirmation. The gospel quotes he opened to were these: "If you wish to be perfect, go sell everything you possess and give it to the poor, and you will have a treasure in heaven. Take nothing for your journey, and if any man wishes to come after me, he must deny himself." Francis then explained to his two brothers, quote, "This is our life and rule, and that of all who want to join our company. Go therefore and fulfill what you have heard," end quote. So in 1209, Francis and his brothers headed to Rome to have an audience with Pope Innocent III in order to propose his forma vitae, or first rule, for his order. You can see here the Pope's not too excited about this at first, but you know they won him over eventually. And the Pope gave oral approval to Francis, and the evidence for it is considered to be lost, but we do have indications of its existence in the later rule of 1221, and in writings by some of the medieval biographers of St. Francis. Francis matured into a charismatic and enthusiastic preacher with an uncompromising commitment to his faith. He was soon preaching in up to 5 villages per day with an aspiration and devotion that everyday people could understand. In 1213, Count Orlando Catani heard Francis preach and was moved to offer Francis a mountainous parcel of land he owned called Mount Alvernia, which is now La Verna, in order for Francis to use in any way he liked. Count Catani's story is relayed in The Little Flowers of St. Francis, a compendium of 53 short chapters about the saint's life published in Italian in the 14th century by an anonymous author, most likely Ugolino Brunforte, who lived between 1262 and 1348, a few decades after Francis passed away. Appended to the little flowers are five sections related to the events on La Verna, known as the Considerations of the Sacred and Holy Stigmata. The artworks selected for the exhibition mostly reference events in the third consideration, which discusses the seraphical apparition and the impression of the most sacred stigmata. According to the considerations, there were no witnesses to the seraphical apparition. However, Francis relayed the events to Brother Leo, who was asked to dress Francis's wounds thereafter. And I just include this. This is the relic of the cloak Francis was wearing at the time of the stigmata, and it's in the Chapel of Relics at La Verna. After Francis's unprecedented stigmatization, he was referred to as the standard bearer of Christ, or the mirror of Christ, or even the new or second Christ, Alter Christus. Shortly after his death, the Franciscan order was quick to commission works of art depicting stories of the saint's life, which drew parallels to the life of Christ, a similar tradition to what we saw in the Pauper's Bible, which depicted the Old Testament as a prefigurement to the new. In this German 15th century woodcut on the left, we find similarities to traditional depictions of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane on the right. The one on the right was done later, but that's the tradition I'm talking about, where an angel announces Christ's coming crucifixion to him, and the disciples are asleep and completely oblivious in the foreground. And you can see the similarity here with Brother Leo. In this elegant illustration from a now lost choir book, we see Francis kneeling in a riverbed, a highly unusual choice for a stigmatization image, but it does recall images of the baptism of Christ. And in this virtuoso chiaroscuro woodcut, we see Francis carrying a full-size cross through the wilderness, recalling Christ on his way to the crucifixion. So I think that gives you a sense of the parallels being made in art at that time. Displaying an intimate mystical event, such as the stigmatization of Francis, posed unique challenges for artists. In surveying the material for this exhibition, I found a variety of artistic approaches to the subject, as well as some standard iconography found in most. Brother Leo is usually seen either reading or sitting childlike in the background. Usually there is a church represented in an architectural style familiar to the artist, such as a German or a Dutch church, and so forth. It seems clear that with few exceptions, most artists had never actually been to La Verna. The main challenge seems to have been, how do you depict one figure transferring the five wounds of the stigmatization to another, while ideally being able to see both figures? I particularly like this little German woodcut solution. Here, a life-size serif soars out from behind Francis's head, a rare and innovative approach to the subject. In so doing, both figures face the viewer, and the crucifixion wounds of Francis are prominently displayed. You will recall that few people at this time could read, so artists had to visually emphasize the identifying attributes of a saint in these types of pilgrim images. In this tiny, exquisite engraving by Lucas van Leyden, the lines that transfer the wounds of Christ to Francis resemble delicate threads and are barely visible, whereas the divine light that Francis shares with the seraph is instead emphasized through the prominent aureoles surrounding each. Unlike the earlier woodcut, the seraph here is tiny, much like the portable objects of personal devotion seen in many paintings at this time. Brother Leo sits with his back to the viewer. You can see him here, oblivious to the profound scene unfolding right next to him. Central to the image is a book, presumably the Bible, in a traveler's case here. Its centrality emphasizes to viewers the importance of a life devoted to Scripture, one of the key issues addressed by the Protestant Reformation. And here we see this gorgeous Titian again. Titian approached the subject of Francis's stigmatization in a bold new way. He placed both Francis and Brother Leo with their backs to the viewer, And instead of depicting the traditional serif, he depicts a small cross approaching from the distance, way up here, and the radiance of which dissolves the tops of the trees, all done in amazing slices of wood. Brother Leo shields his eyes, but is an active witness to the scene. And we see the Bible laying discreetly in the grass next to the saint over here. Here is a glorious 18th century drawing by the German artist Johann Enzensberger. I call his the Game of Twister solution to this artistic challenge. Enzensberger directly connects Christ's wounds to Francis without crossing those lines of force in the composition. He achieves this by creatively twisting Francis's limbs so that his left foot can receive the wound from the left foot of Christ, and so forth. In this way, Enzensberger stayed true to his understanding of the event while also creating a dynamic and bold composition. Where he departed from traditional iconography was in doing away with the cross behind the serif altogether and adding God the Father above, which is very unusual. A new and unusual twist to the subject. Beginning in 1517, Catholicism came under attack from the Protestant Reformation, begun by the German priest Martin Luther. He called out corruption in the church, denounced the church's extravagance, and questioned core Catholic beliefs. The Catholic Church responded by holding a series of 25 ecumenical meetings in Trent, known as the Council of Trent, over a number of years. During and after the so-called Counter-Reformation, or Catholic Reformation, the church quickly commissioned artworks which strengthened their views. They vigorously maintained the veneration of saints and reaffirmed the importance of images for imparting doctrine to the lay people. The council felt that images of saints offered a model of piety that might inspire viewers to imitate the behavior of the holy figure. In this stunning painting by Bernardo Strozzi, we see Francis looking directly at the viewer, imploring one to follow his example of prayer and renunciation. Strozzi, by the way, was a Capuchin monk himself, which was a branch of the Franciscan order. Saint Francis was a popular choice to promote the Catholic agenda at this time. He appealed to the reformers' desire for a life devoted to scripture and humility, but he also served as a model Catholic because he honored the church hierarchy and was known for his tender, wholehearted devotion toward the Virgin Mary, who was regarded as the mother of the church in Roman Catholic Mariology. But even before the Council of Trent, we see new iconographic trends becoming popular and were promoted by Catholic patrons. Compositions with the Virgin Mary and infant Jesus side by side with saints and a donor are called sacra conversazione, or holy conversations. They suggest a mystical yet familial relationship between the holy figures. And they're not done in an altar configuration where you might have the Holy Family up above and the rest of us down below. It's a whole new style in this little square format where they're in the same space, speaking familially. During this period, during the Counter-Reformation period, we find entirely new representations of Francis. In this etching by Facchini, Francis has mystically received the baby Jesus from a floating vision of the Virgin Mary. This event was never part of the Franciscan legend, although a similar experience was documented about another friar, not Francis. Transferring that event onto Francis himself seemed a natural outcome of the renewed focus on him during the Counter-Reformation, and it became a trend. You start to see this scenario played out in a lot of art, as we saw in the Milan image earlier. This engraving includes several details from the Little Flowers of St. Francis, such as the presence of the falcon who reportedly woke St. Francis daily for his prayers. It's way up here in the tree. And the blazing light on the Mount of Laverna at the time of the stigmatization, which was witnessed by local farmers. And I think you can make one out here pointing to the sky. This adherence to texts by artists was a pervasive trend during the Counter-Reformation period. And it's really new. We don't see these details in the earlier images. The vigorous commissioning of images of Francis at this time dovetailed with another Franciscan goal to legitimize Francis's spiritual authority as the new Christ. In this mid-17th century engraving, we find Francis's body literally merged with the body of Christ, together enfolded by the wings of the seraph. Hope you can make that out. One is robed, the other is the almost nude Christ. And the landscape in the middle section shows La Verna on the right, Alvernia, and Calgary on the left, and we see Assisi and Nazareth compared or joined together in the lower section. I think the message here could not be more clear. Now a bit about our artist, Jacopo Legozzi. He was born to a family of artists renowned for their luxury craftsmanship in both painting and decorative arts, such as embroidery and inlaid marble surfaces known as pietra dura, a term for using cut and fitted, highly polished colored stones to create images. This design was by Legozzi, done around 1600. The Legozzi family enjoyed commissions from the Dukes of Milan, as well as the emperors Maximilian and Ferdinand. A teenage Jacopo was present in Trent during the years of the Council of Trent. Jacopo arrived in Florence in 1577, a mature artist. He was hired by the court of Duke Francesco de' Medici, the Grand Duke, but he was also commissioned by the eminent Bolognese naturalist Ulisse Aldrovandi, and he spent 10 years copiously illustrating birds, animals, and botanic specimens with immense precision and an imaginative and delicate expressiveness. I'm just going to show you a couple examples of these beautiful works done in gouache. This one we acquired recently in the National Gallery's collection. We had the pleasure of borrowing many of those for the National Gallery's 2002 exhibition, The Flowering of Florence, Botanical Art for the Medici, which was my first happy introduction to Legozzi's talents. However, as a court artist, Legozzi was not permitted to take on independent commissions. So when he did so in 1583, he lost his court position and shifted his production to altarpieces and allegorical compositions, usually commissioned one at a time, such as this example of Avarice from a series he produced of the seven cardinal or deadly sins. We own the drawing on the left of Avarice. You can see all this abundance of wealth underneath her and death ready to carry her away. And a detail painting taken from a portion of this is up in the Metropolitan's collection. Just gives you a sense of what he was working on. The author of our volume, Brother Lino Moroni, was a Franciscan observant and the provincial minister for the Tuscan order. Fra Moroni had already worked with Legozzi when the artist produced a series of frescoes for the Chiesa di San Salvatore, or the Church of Saint Savior of All Saints in Florence, which was essentially a Franciscan church. It's the outside of the church there. And this is a drawing in the Art Institute of Chicago that Legozzi did as a preparation for one of the frescoes that's in that church now. In short, Legozzi was a natural choice for Brother Moroni to hire to create detailed topographical drawings of La Verna. And if you look closely, this is the altar of the Ogni Santi Church. On the altar, there are three little vignettes in pietra dura. These are all taken, they're reproducing Legozzi's drawings for our volume. So there's a lot of ties between Florence and this church in particular and La Verna. So, before the 17th century, most artists relied on their imaginations to depict La Verna. A rare exception is found in the fresco painted by Domenico Ghirlandaio between 1483 and 1486. And I'll show you a detail of the mountain there. Ghirlandaio seems to have observed the buildings at La Verna closely, rendering them with remarkable accuracy. You can see here the ancient path leading up to what's called the ancient entrance to La Verna, the little church of St. Mary, which Francis actually dictated the dimensions of this church. He wanted it to match exactly his beloved Portiuncola church outside Assisi. And that abuts the larger church, which was built later, between 1348 and 1509. And on our far left is the Chapel of the Stigmata on top of this dramatic cliff. It was built in 1263 over the exact site of the stigmatization. This is probably the truest depiction of La Verna before Jacopo Lagozzi created his designs. Which finally leads us back to our volume. By now, I hope you can understand the motivation to have a volume illustrating the site of Francis' stigmatization created at this time. But the question remains, who was it created for? As I mentioned, there are only 11 copies known in public institutions, which means it's very rare. It would have been expensive to create, especially with the flaps carefully glued down one at a time. And it's a folio size, which means it's rather large. So you wouldn't want to carry it around like a guidebook in a practical sense. Therefore, I believe it's intended to be studied from far away and by the affluent, whether the religious or secular affluent, I'm not yet sure, but most likely religious, we just don't know. After my exhibition was mounted, I received an honors thesis about this book from a talented undergraduate at Princeton named Jacqueline Gufford. Jacqueline made a sound argument that the volume follows the medieval tradition of stationary or mental pilgrimage books. Those were text-based books, not illustrated. And they were made specifically for cloistered nuns and monks so that they could read detailed descriptions about the Holy Land and make a pilgrimage there in their mind because they weren't permitted to leave. Our volume departs from that tradition in that it is heavily illustrated, it's not text-based, and it's not of the Holy Land. It's the first volume of its kind devoted to the sanctuary of a saint. So let's take a closer look at the volume. On the left is our library's copy, and on the right is a detail of our other copy in the art collection. And you might recall when I spoke about printmaking and the requirement to incise one's design in reverse in order for it to print correctly, we find an example here of an oversight. Lagozzi most likely intended to depict the side wound of St. Francis on his right side, which is the traditional side it's depicted on. The design, however, was not reversed for the plate, and therefore the wound printed on his left side. So you see it here, printed on his left. And then later, somewhat crudely, someone went in and by hand tried to camouflage the old wound and add it, correcting it on this other copy. The frontispiece overall is unlike anything else in the volume. It depicts Francis wearing his humble robe, prominently displaying the nail heads through each palm. But he's surrounded by a crowded interweaving of material trappings, some from the church hierarchy, some secular, and some militaristic. Lagozzi was a religious man, and this frontispiece appears to be a not-so-subtle critique of the vanity and decadence that Catholicism was being widely criticized for at this time. After moving past the frontispiece, we encounter the natural splendor and monastic simplicity of La Verna as seen through Lagozzi's illustrations. Here is a three-page fold-out of the dramatic cliff upon which Francis was known to have wrestled the devil and ultimately obtained the stigmata. We can see the sanctuary lining the top of the cliff and the old road leading up to the entrance here. It's a different vantage point than Ghirlandaio was using, and most of the forest has overgrown our view of the sanctuary. Lagozzi focused a lot more in this depiction on the cliff and on the forest than on the actual buildings. This scene narrates the story of St. Francis's first visit to La Verna. As he climbed the hill with his companions, they were greeted by a large flock of birds of different varieties. To mark the location of the event, the chapel of the Stigmata, seen on the right, was erected in 1602, only 5 years before Lagozzi visited there. Clearly, there was strong support for fomenting the legacy of Francis during these years, not only with the commission of this volume, but also with new structures being added to La Verna around the same time. Our little tour, this as you leave the chapel and proceed up the old path, this is what you see today. The path is quite steep and makes sharp corners as you ascend toward what is called the ancient entrance, which you can see there, and finally the door. The translated text above the entrance, carved in both Latin and Italian, reads, "Not in all the world is there a more holy mountain." When you go through, you find yourself in the Piazzale, where the large church is, and here is Legozzi's rendering of it, which is quite accurate. There may be some changes between when he made this 400 years ago and today, but very few. We know because of the cliff that we just walked up that there's no way for Legozzi to have drawn this view from a proper distance. He would have had to study each of the buildings and the church and the piazza from different angles and then reassemble this view. Then he created this two-page foldout that's really awkwardly pasted together, most likely not by him because he was a perfectionist, but by someone working in the printing studio or publishing house. You see this prominent flag in his illustration, which is kind of unusual to be sitting there so obviously. So I did a detail of it here. It depicts the Paschal Lamb, a representation of Christ in the form of a lamb with a halo and gripping a banner with a cross. This is the heraldic symbol for the Florentine Wool Guild, which funded the completion of the large church in 1509. There was a lot of funding coming from Florence to La Verna. As we go past the church, this is what we find. We see a doorway leading down to a place called Sasso Spico, the projecting rock. But first, we'll go through, we'll go down, we'll look back toward those steps that we just came down, and we see the chapel of the cardinal. You can see that the contemporary view is almost identical to what Legozzi was depicting. The illustration, this illustration is one of the two that is on view in the exhibition. We'll proceed down to Sasso Spico, very unusual place. I'm going to show you a couple slides of it. It's this overhanging, dramatically cut, massive boulder. And here's Legozzi's illustration for it. According to the legends, St. Francis spent time in prayer here under this overhanging rock and had the revelation that a powerful earthquake at the moment of Christ's crucifixion created the fissures and broken stones of La Verna. There is still a wooden cross, such as the one depicted in the print, to mark the spot of Francis's vision, which mystically linked La Verna to the hill of Golgotha where Christ was crucified. This is just looking around from underneath there, you see the dramatic views. Now we get to Legozzi's plan, which begins sort of halfway down the corridor of the stigmata. And there's an inconspicuous little doorway here to what is called the bed of St. Francis. Over here is the precipice we'll discuss in a moment, and then the chapel of the stigmata at the end. When you open this little door, it basically opens to the other side of this gorge, which cuts underneath and runs all the way over through by Sasso Spico. This area is called the bed of St. Francis. And it is the other illustration on view in the exhibition. As you can see, Legozzi engraved a large flap depicting rocks and boulders, which camouflages the cave where the bed is located. The bed is simply a rock that Francis was known to have slept on. And you can see this is his flap, which you can barely make out, but it camouflages what's behind it. So when you peel it back here, you see the bed and this sort of cave. One odd aspect of this illustration is that the doorway from the corridor is depicted accurately in terms of its location and how you would exit it. But the bed of St. Francis is on the other side from where it actually is. It actually would be over here, and you turn right. So for whatever reason, Legozzi partially reversed his design for this print, but not completely. It's very unusual. Oh, and this is just leading down to the bed. This is what you see on either side. It's very dramatic. And there is the actual bed, which was covered with a grate so that pilgrims would stop chipping away little pieces of the rock and taking it away. This print illustrates an episode from the Considerations of the Holy Stigmata. In the story, Francis was said to have struggled with the devil atop the precarious rock cliff of Laverna. When it seemed the devil would succeed in throwing Francis from the cliff, the rock apparently softened like wax to receive and protect the friar, leaving a permanent concave shape in the rock. The site was later safeguarded with a visitor railing, which amusingly was included in Legozzi's design as a liftable overslip, so that viewers might imagine how frightening the cliff is without the guardrail. One of our copies is missing its flap, so it's just gone, which over 400 years is not too surprising, and this one has it. Now the actual cliff, this is looking up at that modern guardrail and looking down the cliff. It really is dramatic and quite beautiful. And this is looking out from the top. It's gorgeous Italian landscape. When you turn away from the rail, you see the outside of the chapel of the Stigmata and then the interior. The chapel was built in 1263 over the exact spot where Francis received the stigmata. He wanted it preserved. Featured in the chapel is the magnificent altarpiece by Andrea della Robbia, installed in 1481, the largest della Robbia terracotta relief ever made. It's nearly 19 and a half feet high. Atypical of Legozzi, the details in the engraving seem hastily completed. For example, the curved top of the altarpiece here awkwardly abuts a flat ceiling. The current groin vault that you see here in the photograph may have been added later, but even if the original ceiling had been flat, the print presents an unrealistic architectural space, one in which the altarpiece would not have fit. The engraving also omits, changes, or simplifies many details of the actual altarpiece. He's left out the central figures here, and there are other things that differ. Instead, his engraving focuses as much on the figures and their actions as on the decor. Two standing friars point to the sacred site, hooded monks stand respectfully in the choir, and worshipful pilgrims in the foreground are moved by the holy ground on which they kneel. All serve to emphasize the sanctity of this chapel, the most revered site within the sanctuary of Laverna. Here's a detail of that gorgeous altarpiece. And finally, Legozzi's illustration of the seraphic vision and Francis's stigmatization. The key to this illustration on the left describes the distance or height between the base of the rock and the feet of St. Francis as being 80 open arms. Lengths, and 60 arms wide. And he uses these letters like A, there's A, and there's A, so you can sort of, he's measuring exactly that, and B to B is 60, etc. He also notes the bridge that connects the main mountain to the remote precipice on which Francis was secluded. There's a little tree they put over it to make a bridge, and I think the letter C is there. There's Brother Leo, cute little Brother Leo, shielding his eyes from the blazing vision of the seraph. Interestingly, the cliff is far more prominent in the scene than the seraph or Francis. That, combined with details like the dimensions of the cliff, leave viewers to contemplate not only Francis's spiritual achievement, but also the awe inspired by the sight itself. The detail of Francis, you can see there, is replicated here in Pietradura, although it's much harder to make out in the stones today. Although I cannot take you to Laverna personally, I hope you have enjoyed our mental or stationary pilgrimage this afternoon, and I hope you might feel better equipped to understand and appreciate the rare and wonderful works in the exhibition. Thank you for joining me.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.